Mary Gordon was in a taxi cab and felt a bit trapped because she was listening to an evangelical preacher on the radio. But it got her thinking about her attitudes about her own religion, the religion she grew up with. And it sent her back to reading the Gospels. And that has led to her latest book called Reading Jesus, A Writer's Encounter with the Gospels. It is published by Pantheon. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And how do you see this as fitting in with the body of your work, your novels, your memoirs, the literary criticism? There was another, I know you wrote a book, a brief biography of Joan of Arc, but that's nothing like this.
No. I guess the constant in everything I do, I think, could be put under the heading of meditation. That what I do in the world is to contemplate or to meditate in whatever form, through fiction, through memoir. I think that I take an image, an idea, and I spin it, however it's going to be spun. And one of the things that the Gospels did was it was my first example of narrative. They were my first stories.
Had you read them all? You went to Catholic school, you went to parochial school.
We didn't read the Gospels when I was brought up in the 50s. It's not that we were actually forbidden as Catholics to read the Bible, but we certainly weren't encouraged to read it. That was something Protestants did. So I heard them in church in a very fragmented way. And it occurred to me when I heard the evangelical preacher screaming, and I thought, this is really not what I think the Gospels are, that I had never read them all the way through.
Now, where were you in your relationship to the church at this point? You wrote a memoir about your father, who was a self-hating Jew who converted to Catholicism. But for a while, weren't you rather estranged from the church?
I was estranged, I would say, for a good 20 years. And I think that what happened as I got older, as I had children, as sexuality became less central in my life, I could find my way back to the church. Because if I were Pope, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon, but should they elect me, I would say to the church, shut up about sex for 100 years and see what else there is to talk about. Like a lot of other people, I was very alienated from the church, largely because of its sexual phobia and its misogyny. And as I got older, I began to realize that I didn't have to listen to them about that.
There's also the fact that you travel in certain circles. You are you teach at a university, and it's my sense that if somebody learns that a colleague is very religious, that person loses a little bit of credibility. I mean, it's unfortunate, but isn't that the way it is?
Well, if you tell people you're Catholic, they take 90 IQ points off you. Particularly, and I utterly understand why.
Even though some pretty great writers were practicing Catholics.
Yes, they were, but that was considered then and this is now.
And they were French, usually.
Yes, or Italian. And when you consider the kind of intellectual censorship that comes out of the Vatican and the moral nonsense that comes out of the Vatican, I understand why anybody would be non-Catholic. But it is an allowable prejudice. One is allowed to be prejudiced, certainly against Catholics and against people of faith, without understanding that Pat Robertson and I are really not the same person.
Well, Graham Greene was a practicing Catholic, but perhaps the criticism of the church gave him a certain amount of credibility.
Well, it gave him a certain amount of credibility, but at the end of the day, he was kind of a team player in a way that I'm not. So that he kind of got off on saying, I'm a sinner, but I don't question the judgment of sins. I say, no, I'm not a sinner in the way that you think I am, and your definition of sin is lacking. So I'm actually not on the same page as Graham Greene.
So what did you object to during the cab ride? What was the fundamentalist preacher saying?
Well, he was talking about a text from Matthew, which was about at the end of the world, Jesus will separate the sheep from the goats, and the goats will go to everlasting fire, and the sheep will be saved. And he was saying that the goats were homosexuals, divorcees, and abortionists. Well, that's not what the text says. Jesus says the people who are going to go to everlasting fire are those who did not feed the hungry and give drink to the thirsty. So again, what upset me was the way that the religious right has taken the Gospels and really distorted them for their own agenda, which is an agenda of mainly sexual, gender, and political anxiety. That's not Jesus. Jesus says almost nothing about sex. He doesn't seem very interested in it.
So you went back to the original text to find out what Jesus was saying?
Yes. Always understanding that you can never read this text innocently. You go to it with an overlay of image and your own history. And I was trying to say, what is it to read this? It's not like reading King Lear. It's not like reading the Brothers Karamazov, but we call it reading. Well, so what kind of reading is it?
Well, you were reading a narrative, although it's really a number of narratives.
Yes.
So were you reading it as literature? Were you reading it for some kind of revelation? Were you noticing that in the various retellings of the stories, that there were variations, sometimes discrepancies that people later have used to argue against the truth of the Bible?
I can only answer that yes and no. To say that I was reading the Gospels as literature would be disingenuous, because I read them thinking that I had always read them thinking this is going to tell me how to live a life.
Were you reading them in which translation were you reading them in?
I read them in several. I really read them in several, going from the King James all the way through the Revised Standard and to the Douay-Rheims, which was the Catholic version, to the Jerusalem. But I couldn't read them as literature. But being trained as a reader and writer, I could only read them using the habits of reading that I had garnered over a lifetime. So what I wanted to do was look at the words and see what the words were actually saying, always understanding that actually saying was a very vexed concept.
Did you read commentaries along with the Gospels?
A little bit, but one of the things that I thought was part of my task was that the wonderful scholarship, which I immensely admire, didn't seem to be hitting the appetite that the fundamentalists were, because scholars have to be unemotional. They were not speaking in personal and emotional tones, and the fundamentalists were. So I thought my task was, how can I speak emotionally and personally in a way that scholars can't, but not hysterically the way the fundamentalists were? So I didn't think that I was going to cover the same ground that the scholars did. I read a little bit of commentary, but my project was to say to the ordinary reader, as I said, my fantasy reader was Skye Masterson from Guys and Dolls, who knew everything about the Bible because he'd read it in so many hotel rooms. Well, he didn't have Raymond Brown in his hotel room. He just had that Bible, and that's what people have. They have this book that has, you know, their mother's wedding in it and the birth of their child, and that's what they have, that book. So I was really wanting to go to that book, those words, and see if I could replicate a reading experience that was more, as Virginia Woolf would say, that of the common reader.
My guest is Mary Gordon, who's the author of 6 novels, including The Company of Women, Final Payments, and Spending, also a number of memoirs. And she teaches at Barnard.
Yes.
She also, her latest book is a bit of a departure, called Reading Jesus, A Writer's Encounter with the Gospels. It is published by Pantheon. Are the Gospels believed to be the Word of God in the same way that the Old Testament is?
Well, you have to say, what is the Word of God? And I think what you think the Word of God means is dependent upon who you are. So what I think the Word of God means is different from what a fundamentalist thinks the Word of God is. I think it was written by human beings, and yet somehow it has an accretion of meaning and meaningfulness that's unique. But I don't think that, you know, I don't think that it's some kind of Caravaggio-esque moment where the angel comes and touches St. Matthew on the forehead. I think whoever Matthew was, he was inspired in the way that great writers were. The point is that this text, unlike other texts, has a life that is lived in a community.
Well, there's a
through
lot of
history.
There's a lot of controversy because we have these four narratives, but there are other narratives, and they keep on popping up. The latest one was the Gospel of Judas.
Yes.
There's the whole issue over which ones made it into the final version, because there are the various Gnostic Gospels as well. Did you find that the writers of the four that made it had different goals as well?
Well, they were writing for different communities. And again, I can't make this point more clearly than I have. This is a text which lives a life among living people. So Matthew's writing for a very Jewish community. He has a lot of Old Testament references. Luke is much more literary, and he begins it. This is to you, Theophilus. It's essentially for a Gentile audience. Mark is much more for a small and embattled community. And John is very influenced by the Greeks. He's much more philosophical. So you can really hear very, very different tonalities.
Well, you'd heard all of these stories before. Did it make a difference to read them in their entirety and in context? And at this stage in your life?
It made a very great difference because I had to deal with the paradox that this was a book, and I'm a person who lives by books. It's a book, but it's not a book. And Jesus is a character, but he's not a character.
And he's not the kind of person we can connect to in the same way that we might connect to a St. Francis of Assisi, for example.
No. And also what was wonderful for me was how contradictory he was. That it seemed to me the most valuable lesson at the end of the gospel was there was no one answer. There was no one way. There was a tremendous fluidity to this narrative. There was a tremendous fluidity to the notion of how does one live a life. And I don't think I had been that aware of that before.
But there are these puzzling stories, like when he curses a fig tree for not producing fruit out of season.
Yes, which is just Jesus being a brat. and I really loved that because it was, seemed to me, an emblem of that part of human beings which says, why can't I have what I want? Why can't I make the world be the way I want it to be? And how astonishing that was left in, because it really doesn't make Jesus look very good. So I loved that moment of peak, divine peak, in which Jesus is almost more like Zeus than St. Francis of Assisi, certainly.
You do love the Beatitudes.
I love the Beatitudes.
Did you appreciate them as a writer or as a believer?
I don't think you have to. I appreciated them rhythmically as a writer. I don't think you have to believe in anything to think that the Beatitudes are valuable. What I really like about them is that they're so uncapitalist, that there's nothing about being honest. There's nothing about keeping your word. They suggest that blessedness is achieved by a kind of generosity of spirit, by an almost impermeableness of love and openness. And I don't think you have to believe in anything to say that is a great way to live.
What about Mary Magdalene, who has been described as so many different things by different people?
Well, whoever Mary Magdalene was, there's in the culture a moment in which she is supposed to have washed Jesus' feet with her hair. And that's a moment that I love a lot in the gospel because it's very shocking, because Jesus says, when she's criticized for spending too much money on perfume, the poor you will always have with you. Well, that's shocking. This man who says you're gonna go to hell if you don't feed the poor says, yeah, but, you know, the perfume, that was a good investment. Screw the poor. They'll be around tomorrow. And it was a moment that's very important to me because it suggests that beauty is also a way to salvation.
You found the miracles a problem, and I wonder why. If Jesus is the Son of God, wouldn't he have been capable of performing all those miracles?
Well, the reason why they're problematic to me is who didn't get cured. And having been brought up in the way that I was, the notion that miracles are kind of a lottery, that if you get the right combination of numbers, you're okay, that's very problematic to me. And so miracles are problematic to me because of who is not miraculously saved And I don't like to think that God is that kind of broker.
Just one more thing. The apocalypse is very powerful in the minds of many evangelicals. How powerful is it in the rereading of the Gospels?
It doesn't really do it for me. It's not the way my imagination goes. I also find it very dangerous because I feel like the remnant always really likes thinking that we're the remnant and you're not. I can only go to the apocalypse as a source of Blake. That's how I like it. But the notion that, you know, the trumpets are coming and you're in big trouble, it doesn't do it for me particularly.
Mary Gordon's latest book is called Reading Jesus, A Writer's Encounter with the Gospels. It's published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Great pleasure, as always.
Hope to see you again soon.
Yes.